This program is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Ford Foundation.
Hello, I'm Michelle Norris, and this is Every Voice and Sing, a look at the choral music legacy of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities of the United States of America.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand.
In this episode, a different drummer. We will look at the birth and rise of what's now known as gospel music, primarily through the life and determined efforts of Thomas A. Dorsey.
Thomas Andrew Dorsey is considered the father of gospel music, and we always celebrate the great trials and tribulations that he went through to get the world to recognize this music. But what most people don't realize is that by the time that Mr. Dorsey came into gospel, a kind of gospel had been in existence for almost 20 years.
Dr. Horace Boyer is author of How Sweet the Sound, The Golden Age of Gospel, and he's professor emeritus of African American music and music theory at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
The gospel quartets and gospel in the black community has a very interesting birth, because in 1905, there are so many black college jubilee singers out in the rural that they're taking money from each other. And by 1905, Fisk University says, listen, we've got to bring our jubilee singers off the road. 9, 12, 15 people are charging us too much money. So they got the idea of sending out a quartet, the Fisk Jubilee Quartet. Then Hampton got a quartet.
Others must make ring all the poetry and all the melodies to our world's admiration.
College campuses is where quartets naturally formed, coming out of the choir tradition. And so I think that to this day, Take Six owes a lot to the quartet tradition from which we grew.
Cedric Dent's PhD is on the harmonic development of black religious quartet singing. He and Mark Kibble do most of the arrangements for their jazz-influenced gospel group, Take Six.
Look at here, ain't you sick and tired? You're going round in circles, talking about your problems till y'all are blue. Don't mean to be rude, sure don't mean to bust your groove. Well, you sure enough talking, but what you gon' do? Cause it's one thing to believe and know you can achieve. It's another thing to do it till you see your dreams come true. The river won't divide till you put your fears aside. Step on in it till you win it. See you on the other side.
The first gospel music that really sort of began to take the country by storm started with quartets, which, of course, again, we trace back to the college choirs.
Dr. Boyer.
In 1915, in Bessemer, Alabama, we get the beginning of black gospel quartets. What had happened was these boys who had been to college came back home. However, they were not singing before college audiences. They were not singing before white audiences. They were singing before black church audiences. And in the black church, we say, amen. hallelujah, sing it, so that they began to change their singing to elicit and to generate this kind of singing.
Tell Martha, don't you moan.
Tell Martha not to moan.
Well, I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Tell Martha, don't you moan.
Tell Martha not to moan.
Cause Pharaoh's army.
Pharaoh's army.
Drowned in the Red Sea.
Drowned in the Red Sea.
I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
It was for years, from I'd say about the 1920s to the 1940s, that it was the gospel quartet, the male quartet, that was the most prominent style of gospel music. And now Mark can tell you about who a lot of these groups were.
Wow, the Swan Silvertones come to mind.
But there was also another equally powerful source for the early black gospel music, Dr. Boyer.
We go back to April 9th, 1906. In the 300 block of Azusa Street in Los Angeles, California, when the Holy Ghost fell with William Joseph Seymour and his band of Pentecostal holiness people. And from that kind of setting, we get the beginning of gospel music. We get a return to the kind of music that the slaves were singing. Stuff like, I'm a soldier in the army of the Lord, soldier in the army. Well, the Baptists weren't singing that at that point. The Methodists weren't singing it. It was the sanctified people. It was the holiness church. It was the apostolic church that was singing it.
This other side of the two-pronged gospel route would later be very significant. But between the 1890s and the 1920s, few people had time to notice how one genre of black music was developing.
Because everything that we were programmed in was Yassa, Nosa, Yassa Balls.
Dr. Lena McLinn is the author of the music textbook, Pulse, The History of Music. She's also a classical music composer. She's written about 9 gospel songs and is the niece of Thomas A. Dorsey.
And we had our heads down and our spirits up. But you must remember that was a time when segregation was so prominent and the Ku Klux Klan was so busy.
Keeping your head down, being carefully vigilant, was mandatory. It was a very dangerous and violent period, especially for African Americans. There were riots across the country. Usually, it was a striving black community being destroyed, its economic and political power targeted by white mobs. In places like Brownsville, Texas, Chicago, and other cities, armed blacks gave as good as they got. It was more like race warfare than race riots. Other areas, like Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Wilmington, North Carolina, did not fare as well.
Riots didn't become associated with black people until the 1960s. Riots before that had been white people rioting.
Dr. Heather Williams teaches 19th century African American history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her latest book, Self-Taught, African American Education in Slavery and Freedom, recounts the black struggle for education during enslavement and the U.S. Reconstruction era of the 19th century.
And so 1866, you've got a major riot in Memphis, Tennessee. You've got one also that same year in New Orleans. Somehow, black people still keep building. and they start acquiring wealth. I just saw a report about the Wilmington riot in 1896. Some people are now calling it a coup d'etat because there had been a government elected and some white men decided that that was not the right government and staged a riot and went into the state house and took control. And there had been a thriving black community in Wilmington.
Just as there had been in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. And yet, in that same period, despite the adversity, there was this amazing growth of black arts and culture. It blossomed into the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s, and the musical explosion lasted even longer. Dr. Horace Boyer.
In 1920, Mamie Smith records Crazy Blues. By 1930, Bessie is out of here. Bessie Smith. In the 1930s, Duke Ellington is out there. Count Basie is out there. Lionel Hampton is out there. Andy Kirk is out there. And in 1930, Dorsey is out there.
He's out there, but still not fully locked into his new style of religious music. Mr. Dorsey's niece, Dr. Lena McLinn.
Because Dorsey was a blues man. Dorsey was Ma Rainey, the mother of the blues. He was Ma Rainey's musical director. He was Georgia Tom, and he wrote over 100 blues. And he was really cooking. And he got his big hit called Tight Like That. And he was a rich man at 8 o'clock that morning. The stock market crashed, and that night he was a poor man. Mysterious ways. And my grandmother was happy because she didn't want him in the blues field, no way. My grandmother used to stay on him so much about being a sinner. And he would play those ragtime honky-tonk blues, you know, and play for Ma Rainey. And he met a girl named Nettie there, and she was Ma Rainey's costume designer. And they got married. And he would play the blues.
It was great personal tragedy that brought this son of a preacher back to the church once and for all.
He went to direct gospel choir out of town, and his wife Nettie was at home. They were expecting a child. And he drove about 50 miles out and came back, had a fellow with him. The fellow said, I don't think I'll go, I'm going to stay. And he should have stayed, but she was asleep and he didn't pay any attention. And the next night, when he was conducting this choir, they came in and told him that she had died in childbirth. And he was just wiped out. And that's how he wrote, Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand.
When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near when my life is almost gone.
So in that regard, Dorsey is considered the father of gospel music. But what he did was he picked up and made Baptist What these sanctified, holiness, Pentecostal people were already doing. He combined all of this raw refrain material into Precious Lord, Take My Hand, Lead Me On, Let Me Stand. I mean, now that's the kind of poetry that you can't get spontaneously. So you see that Dorsey does begin to refine, give it a certain amount of dignity, take it to the church, take it to the convention, write it out. I mean, the notes, get it printed, published it, and then sells it. So here's the following.
But it was no easy walk in the park for Thomas A. Dorsey and the gospel music tradition he started at the Pilgrim Baptist Church in Chicago in 1932. It was a long, hard, uphill battle.
Now, when we look at the gospel music, we all know that many of the originators of this music started in blues and jazz.
Dr. James Arthur Williams prefers to be called a teacher. He was a choral conductor for a total of 33 years combined at Stillman College and Wilberforce University.
And so the folk in the church got nervous that we were bringing the devil's music in the church. It sort of made them nervous. Dr. Horace Boyer really talks about this.
Dorsey does one thing that upsets the whole area of black church music. Dorsey adds piano to gospel music. See, the a cappella, if we had just had a cappella gospel, nobody would be talking about the blues. Nobody would be talking about jazz. But when you bring that honky-tonk piano in here, the Lord goes to California and leave Chicago out there by itself, and the people just go bonkers.
Dorsey's niece, Dr. Lena McLinn.
He went all over America and organized gospel choirs in churches. First, he was kicked out of most of them.
During that time, late 19th century, early 20th century, the use of the banjo and the guitar and the percussion instruments, even the piano, were considered to be instruments of the world because they were associated with the secular black music. What I mean by that is the blues.
Ethnomusicologist Dr. William B. Garcia has a PhD in choral music literature and conducting. He's the director of the Lincoln University Concert Choir in Pennsylvania.
But initially, the gospel music was not accepted in the African-American church because these churches patterned their worship after the white congregations that they sprang from. And then afterwards, that music was really kind of frowned upon, as the spiritual was initially.
Dr. Horace Boyer.
All of our music is much more accepted now than it was, but there are still congregations that I don't care what kind of gospel it is. It can be smooth gospel or it can be raucous. It's not going to get into some churches. So that Dorsey had the problem of finding an audience, finding singers, finding places where this music could be produced. And that he actually did. It took him 30 years.
It took him 30-plus years because the struggle for acceptance was being waged on more than one front, more than one level. Dr. William Garcia.
And they considered the gospel music to be from the Holiness Pentecostal group. And at that time, the Holiness Pentecostal group were the so-called lower class of African Americans, because the ones that were middle class and above were attending the United Methodist and the AME Church and the Baptist Church, and they didn't sing that kind of music.
This is Every Voice and Sing. I'm Michelle Norris. For many, in the different church denominations from the late 19th century on, the style of worship was obviously tightly connected to the class of those engaged in the worship service. And due primarily to what became known as the Great Migration, class was becoming quite significant. The mass movement north had begun to put poor, so-called lower-class, newly arrived blacks in much closer contact with the already well-established members in the northern black churches. It would soon cause problems. Again, some necessary background. From 1915 through the 1930s, assaults on black political rights, property, even their lives, continued nonstop, especially in the South.
Ida B. Wells started to realize that white men were lynching black men, and they were making a claim that black men were raping white women. And Ida B. Wells started investigating and realizing, wait, there's some economic issues here. This isn't about rape.
Author Heather Williams, on the early days of crusading journalist Ida B. Wells and her campaign against Southern whites who attempted to terrorize black men.
To actually kill men who are doing well economically. And again, as in slavery, you beat people in public. Here you hang people in public or you shoot them. To say to other people, stop this striving. There's a place for you. Slavery's over, but this is a society that we have in the South. It's Jim Crow, and we've put that in place.
In Chicago, the black-owned newspaper, the Chicago Defender, had run its own campaign in support of anti-lynching laws. It had also waged a successful migration campaign warning of the dangers for blacks in the South and pushing job opportunities in the North. Since it was circulated nationally, blacks who were already leaving began to flee the Deep South in droves. The rapid increase in the black population of these northern cities, especially Chicago, was a major sea change. The Chicago Defender dutifully tried to advise its readers to help teach the new arrivals how to fit into their new surroundings.
Seek to instruct the migrants as to the dress, habits, and methods of living necessary to withstand the rigors of the northern climate. As to the efficiency, regularity, and application demanded of workers in the North, every race man owes this to himself as well as to the newcomers, for what affects one affects us all.
Thanks to the Defender's migration campaign, Chicago's black population increased by 50% between 1916 and 1918, just 2 years. There was a noticeable jump in the black church population. The storefront Pentecostal and Holiness churches increased markedly. But the old line established black churches, Baptist, Methodist, and AME church memberships, increased even more dramatically. Problems were inevitable. As author Michael W. Harris writes in The Rise of Gospel Blues, his biographical work on Thomas Dorsey and his music,
because of the social backgrounds of the leadership and the urban locale of these churches, a distinct northern ethos, classical music, non-demonstrativeness, subdued preaching, enjoyed an uncontested prominence. As early as 1920, however, this old line spirit was threatened by the sheer size of the southern invasion.
The newly arrived migrants came from places like Georgia and Mississippi. They were usually poor, from more rural backgrounds. They preferred a much livelier, more demonstrative form of worship, much closer to what the Holiness and Pentecostal churches were doing, closer to the new musical style being pushed by Thomas A. Dorsey.
Thomas A. Dorsey actually didn't start in a small church.
Dr. Horace Boyer.
He began gospel in the very prestigious Pilgrim Baptist Church in Chicago. This is 1932. When Dorsey was invited to start his gospel choir there, Reverend Austin saw, now this is one of the important mainline churches in Chicago, but Reverend Austin brings it in, and there was the head of the music department at Pilgrim Baptist Church was a man named Edward Boatner, who's a very important composer. Edward was so mad when they bought that toe-tapping music in there, he left.
Edward Boatner may have left, but many of the old line members of Pilgrim Baptist stayed. They were not happy with Reverend Austin's alliance with Thomas A. Dorsey and his new toe-tapping style of gospel music. Dorsey had been offered an entry platform, but the struggle for acceptance of his music had only just begun. The music's link to the so-called lower class, holiness, and Pentecostal churches was just one hurdle. The other major obstacle he faced at Pilgrim and other mainline churches was rooted in moral and doctrinal beliefs.
I think it was a moral issue of mixing the sacred and the secular, and that became problematic for those who were morally conscious.
Dr. Eurydice Osterman is on the faculty of Oakwood College, a Seventh-day Adventist school with a rich music tradition near Huntsville, Alabama. She was conductor of the Oakwood College Choir for 12 years.
And the moment he crossed the line and tried to connect the two, it created a disturbance in the church. And I think it was from a moral sense that it was problematic for the churches, because the environment in which the blues and jazz and all of these other secular forms had been born were so different. The lifestyle of those who patronized those types of places.
But Dorsey was sincere in his reconversion and returned to the faith of his Baptist minister father, Dr. Boyer.
Mr. Dorsey told me this because I interviewed him. He says a preacher came to him and says, "Mr. Dorsey, you are not as sick in body as you are in mind. If you'll stop playing the devil's music and play the Lord's music, you'll be all right." That was in 1929, and Mr. Dorsey told me this in 1964, and he said, "I've never been sick a day since."
But his use of the musical language of the joints and the clubs that showcase this secular music was and still is anathema to many equally sincere believers. Dr. Osterman.
I think his conversion was a very sincere conversion. And while it may have been an ingenious creation, still music speaks louder than words because music goes directly to the emotions. So long before words are filtered through your master brain to determine whether they are sacred or secular, the music has already decided and has sent the message of what that is. And so when he combined them, people were hearing sacred words, but they were hearing secular music.
Reverend Eugene Palmore is a program coordinator in the arts ministry at Marble Collegiate Church in New York City. He's a graduate of Morehouse College, and he sang in its glee club under the direction of Wendell Whalum.
Thomas Dorsey was a blues pianist. His wife died. He didn't know how to deal with it. He sits down and he writes, "Precious Lord, take my hand." Is he going to use box language? No, he doesn't have box musical vocabulary. Is he going to use Chopin? Is he going to use anybody else but his own language? No, he has to use what's available to him. So he takes his blues and puts on top of the blues a sacred appeal, an appeal to God, a prayer. You're going to criticize him for that?
The criticism, objections, and resistance would continue for years. And even as these musical battles were being fought within the black churches, the black struggle for full freedom and first-class citizenship continued in the larger society. It was a constant struggle, from those racial clashes in what James Weldon Johnson dubbed the Red Summer of 1919. The anti-lynching campaigns and battles against racial discrimination continued right into the 30s and early 1940s. Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, was symbolic of the country's failed treatment of its formerly enslaved black population. In that 1919 Red Summer, one of the bloodiest riots took place there. 20 years later, in 1939, one of the most public examples of the ongoing discrimination against blacks, also occurred.
The gospel train I'm a-coming, I hear it just at hand. I hear the car wheels rumbling and rolling through the land.
Marian Anderson was one of the greatest contraltos to grace any international concert stage. She was a world-renowned artist and was the first African-American to both entertain at the White House for President and Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt and also solo at the New York Metropolitan Opera.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
In 1939, the DAR, or Daughters of the American Revolution, denied Marian Anderson the right to perform in concert at Constitution Hall in the heart of Washington, D.C. This affront to such an artist outraged many, including First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. Mrs. Roosevelt helped arrange for an alternative concert site.
Like I'm almost gone, always from home.
On Easter Sunday, 1939, Marian Anderson performed in concert at Washington, D.C.'s Lincoln Memorial before an audience of 75,000 people. The DAR continued its discriminatory practices at Constitution Hall into the early 1950s. Interestingly enough, the African-American group they first invited to perform at Constitution Hall was the Tuskegee Concert Choir under the direction of William Levi Dawson. African Americans were divided on whether the Tuskegee Choir should perform, since the DAR made no promises about changing its discriminatory policies against black artists. Mr. Dawson elected to perform, but the Tuskegee Choir's appearance was boycotted and picketed by large numbers of African Americans and other anti-discrimination groups. Discrimination was a national problem, and African Americans fought it on a national level. It was this type of activism against all forms of racial discrimination that eventually played a major role in gaining the inclusion and acceptance of gospel music across the board, from the black churches to the black colleges. Ethnomusicologist Dr. William Garcia.
But that was the beginning of all of that. In the 60s, then, with the revolution taking place on the black college campuses and many white college campuses, where the study of African-American history and African history became very important, then these gospel choirs sprang up. At first, it was not accepted.
A lot of the choral directors just didn't have the background.
Dr. William Henry Caldwell is director of vocal and choral activities at Central State University in Ohio.
Because they don't understand it, they're trying to suppress it or say, you know, this is beneath me, or I've studied at this place and that place, why should I do this? And that's the wrong attitude to take, because it's still great music. Now, there's good gospel and there's bad gospel. All gospel music is not great. So I select gospel music based on the, let's say, the way I can use it within my choir. Richard Smallwood, for example, I love his arrangements.
Holy, holy.
Dr. Roland Carter is now the Ruth S. Holmberg Professor of American Music at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Prior to that, he spent almost a quarter of a century as director of the Hampton University Concert Choir.
Black college choirs, concert choirs, would not touch a piece of gospel music. As a student at these institutions, we were told we couldn't play that. We would get kicked out of the practice rooms if they heard gospel music coming out of the... Oh, absolutely.
Dr. Boyer on his personal experience with that musical struggle.
I go to Bethune-Cookman College, and the choir director, Thomas Daniel Demps, finds out that by this time, my brother and I are recording artists, gospel singers. And even though I had a music scholarship, he would not let me sing in the choir, lest I taint the choir. So my whole freshman year, I didn't sing in the choir. I'm a music major. But I had to prove to him that gospel did not get in my way. Warner Lawson was head of the choir, fabulous choir at Howard University. And he said, there will never be any gospel music in this department as long as I live. By 1969, Warner Lawson was dead, and Richard Smallwood organized the gospel choir at Howard University.
Richard Smallwood and a group of Howard University students commandeered their campus fine arts building for a full week in the late 1960s.
My name is Richard Smallwood. I am a musician. I am a recording artist. I am a writer. And I am a minister, and I do gospel music. I think the thing that I wasn't prepared for was the bias against black music. Now, granted, I loved classical music because I grew up on it, but the only courses that were offered at the School of Music at that time were courses in European music. You could talk about Bach, Chopin, Schubert, Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky, Bartok, whoever, but you couldn't even play gospel music in the practice area. We were not being offered the type of African-American courses that we wanted, not only in music, but just in general. And so we at the School of Music decided we wanted a jazz band, we wanted a jazz department, we wanted to be able to sing gospel, you know, the whole nine yards. We decided that we would take over the fine arts building. We wouldn't let anybody in the building. And I remember sitting and playing and all of us singing gospel music from sun up to sundown until I had blisters on my fingers. We wouldn't let any of the teachers in. We wouldn't let anybody in until the dean would listen to our requests. And he said, I don't want to hear it. And we said, okay, we'll sing and we'll play until you do. And that's what we did.
Their militancy paid off. Howard University incorporated African-American courses into its curriculum. A jazz music department was formed, and the Howard Gospel Choir was born.
And I remember we insisted that we sang on the first graduation after we had been formed. And I remember we got to sing. A lot of the faculty got up and walked out. You know, it was like, you can go anywhere you want to. We're here to stay. We're not going anywhere, you know. So that's how it was.
It is still going strong today. This is Every Voice and Sing. I'm Michelle Norris.
Oh!
Richard Smallwood, in my opinion, has influenced the choral sound in gospel music more than anybody in the last 25 years.
Reverend Eugene Palmore.
He's a classically trained musician with degrees in music composition and theory, and he adds his spin and his take to gospel music.
But a long line of gospel artists flow from the early gospel quartets through Thomas A. Dorsey to Richard Smallwood and beyond. Take Six member, Dr. Cedric Dent.
James Weldon Johnson, who wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing, he once wrote in an article years ago that in the 1920s, quartet singing was so popular that he said, just pick up any four black guys off the street, have one start singing the melody, and the other three will naturally find the other parts. Now, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but it does suggest how popular quartet singing was in the 20s, 1920s.
Dr. Horace Boyer.
In 1919, we get the Silverleaf Jubilee Gospel Quartets. In 1926, we get the Blue Jay. And then in the 1930s, we get the Bertha Wives Singers, who inspired Roberta Martin. And then in 1927, Mahalia comes from New Orleans into Chicago and joins the Johnson Brothers. In 1935, Clara Ward and the Ward Singers of Philadelphia are formed when Thomas A. Dorsey comes to their place. We get the Soul Stirrers, and the Soul Stirrers are coming in from Texas.
But she heard my Jesus was passing by, so she joined the gathering throng.
Reverend Eugene Palmore.
Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers coming out of that gospel quartet tradition. And of course he moves into the secular world, yes. But he's not going to abandon where he was born and the things that have nurtured him to this point. A change is going to come. I was born by the river in a little tent. It almost sounds like Moses. And just like the river, I've been running ever since.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since.
He is speaking about a social condition, but undergirding that, there seems to be this connection to faith in God.
A change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Dr. William Caldwell.
I grew up singing in the Baptist Church, at Eastern Star Baptist Church in Demopolis, Alabama. And I grew up listening to Mahalia Jackson and the Blind Boys and those quartets and things that were prevalent throughout the South at the time. I would hear them every Sunday morning on the local radio station, gospel music.
Horace Boyer.
Naturally, we get Sister Rosetta Tharpe. We get the original gospel harmonettes from Birmingham, Alabama. The Dixie Hummingbirds, Greenville, South Carolina, relocate to Philadelphia. Incidentally, they're still singing. In the 1950s, we get the Caravans, Albertina Walker and Shirley Caesar.
I don't worry when my friends don't believe. I know that God is in command. Hold the power of the world in his hand. I don't worry when my enemies are around. I don't worry when you crush me down. I know that I've got a starry crown, a place reserved where I can sit down.
Well, my name is Pastor Shirley Caesar. I'm the pastor of the Mount Calvary Word of Faith Church in Raleigh, North Carolina.
We were able to get a brief backstage interview with Pastor Shirley Caesar as she prepared for a New York City concert in May of 2006.
I've been pastoring totally 15 years. I heard artists like Mahalia Jackson, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, a lot of those older groups. In fact, I grew up under their their singing ministry during slavery time and during the times that they were trying to press through their hard times. It was those Negro spirituals, if you will, steal away to Jesus. Even Amazing Grace and Blessed Assurance that comes out of the Caucasian background, but still it gave them that strength and that fortitude to want to make it out of what they were going through. When they were not allowed to have their own drums, they made their own beat. The women did the soprano clap, and the men did the bass clap, and they would pat their feet with the bass and the soprano clap, and they made their own music. Some people said that it started with blues. I would rather think that they had to hold on to their faith, and that faith had to come from God himself. And so gospel music is as old as God is.
Dr. Emily Cissy Houston fully agrees. A singer of many musical genres, Cissy Houston is minister of music at New Hope Baptist Church in Newark, New Jersey.
We consider that all the same. You know, spirituals and gospel, all of it derives from each, including jazz and all that business, all comes from the same place. The words are different. The feeling is the same, as far as I'm concerned. That doesn't mean because I might sing secular music that my love isn't as strong as yours or anybody else's.
Her singing career began with her family gospel group, the Drinkard Singers. Long before her daughter Whitney's rise to stardom, Cissy Houston had songs on the soul, pop, rhythm and blues, and gospel charts.
That's what my shows are about, love. Anything that I'm doing, whether it's secular, whether it's gospel, whether it's jubilee, whatever it is, I'm always talking to God. And I try to choose songs that display God, God's love and his forgiveness. I think that's the important thing.
Her musical life has come full circle. She started in gospel when not that many artists were singing it. Now it's once again her main focus, and it's reputedly the largest, fastest growing, and most popular musical genre in the world, Dr. Boyer.
And I must tell you, James Cleveland brought us to our present position of popularity. James Cleveland sang in the choir under Thomas A. Dorsey at Pilgrim Baptist, and Dorsey was great inspiration to him. James thought of the idea of public concerts. He follows Dorsey and organizes a convention.
Dorsey had taken a cue from the National Baptist Convention and started his own gospel music conventions in the 1930s. The Reverend James Cleveland followed Dorsey's example in a big way when he founded the Gospel Music Association of America in 1967 and began holding national conventions. This organization would be a catalyst to propel gospel music to its phenomenal rise in the coming decades.
Lay down. You can lay your head. When the storms of life are raging, you can lay your head. When the enemy's all around you, you can lay your head.
But if James Cleveland was the key individual who spread the flame of gospel music worldwide, just about everyone we spoke with named one group and one song as the indelible watershed of gospel music.
Oh, happy day!
Oh, happy day!
In 1969, Edwin Hawkins puts out Oh Happy Day.
When Oh Happy Day came out, here we go, you know.
Edwin Hawkins, Oh Happy Day hit.
Oh Happy Day, Edwin Hawkins. Before Oh Happy Day, black college choirs, concert choirs, would not touch a piece of gospel music.
Dr. Boyer.
Well, that's like a 2x4 in the history of gospel. That's a structural thing. Because then we go into what is called contemporary gospel. We begin to consciously combine elements of popular music in with that. And of course, then that leads the way to the Wynums in Detroit and the Clark sisters who come from Detroit. And then in 1988, we get these six boys from Oakwood College in Huntsville, Alabama, take six.
And we'll see you on the other side. Oh, come on, come on, get your destiny.
Come on,
get your victory.
God is able.
God is able.
You just say yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Go on, smile again. Go on,
sun's gonna shine again.
You'll get over it. Don't you forget.
And then around 1997 or somewhere in there, we get, maybe a little earlier than 97, we get Kirk Franklin.
We borrowed from the blues. The blues have certainly gotten much from us. And now gospel is borrowing now from the hip-hop. And that's because of a young singer by the name of Kirk Franklin.
The Reverend Kirk Franklin was not the first to use rap to preach and reach a younger hip-hop generation of Christians using their musical approach to gospel music. He will certainly not be the last. Reverend Eugene Palmore.
You have somebody like Curtis Blow going back to this church, which attracts young people. And for someone to say that they don't want hip-hop or they can't stomach hip-hop embracing gospel or gospel embracing hip-hop, which is really what it is, hip-hop adding its voice to gospel, then you're not being true to the message.
Hey, where my old school is at? Old schoolers! Let's go! Come on! I rep Jesus! I rep Christ! Come on! I rep Jesus! I rep Christ! Come on! I rep Jesus! I rep Christ! Come on! I rep Jesus! I rep! Get it crunk with it! The devil can't get it!
But that's a dialogue about the message. We'll need to spend more time exploring. One thing is certain. This hip-hop generation moves to a different drum beat and drummer, just as Thomas A. Dorsey did over 70 years ago. Dorsey's triumph is as groundbreaking, as gargantuan as the battle he had to wage. Dr. Lena McLinn.
He established it all over the world, gospel music. And his precious Lord is in over 300 languages. And he became the father of gospel music.
Hear my cry, hear my call, hold my hand lest I fall. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me home.
Pastor Shirley Caesar.
It all comes out of the heart and the loins of God. And now, hey, gospel music has gone to a brand new dimension, if you will. I don't think that it will ever just be Amazing Grace again. It will never, ever go back to just Blessed Assurance and the old rugged cross. We have this wonderful, wonderful blessing of gospel music of all forms.
I'm Michelle Norris. Thank you for joining us.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, and, in part, by support from Jazz 88.3 FM, WBGO Radio, in Newark, New Jersey. Every Voice and Sing is a production of EVT Educational Productions. Host and narrator, Michelle Norris. Writer-producers, Ann S. Hayward and Eric V. Tate, Jr. Audio design and engineering, Duke Marcos. Technical producers, Jonathan Blakely, Keith Gonzalez, David Tallickson, and Stephen A. Weiss. Researchers, Jackie Farmer and Lynn James. Production associates, Marcos Alvarado, Elizabeth Jarvis, and Lobe Redhawk. Additional musical underscoring composed, arranged, and performed by Onaje Allen Gums. Additional voices, Keith Gonzalez and Raymond Peterson. Advisors, Dr. Roland Carter, the Ruth S. Holmberg Professor of American Music at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and Dr. James Arthur Williams, choral conductor and educator, now retired. Audio consultant, Don Alameda. In-kind services provided by the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, Newark, New Jersey. Our thanks to the following vocal groups: the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Kentucky State University Concert Choir Quartet, the Morgan State University Concert Choir, the Morehouse Glee Club Quartet, Take Six, the Tuskegee University Concert Choir, and the Wilberforce University Concert Choir. Special thanks to Cephas Bowles, Thurston Briscoe, Willix Brown Jr., Nicole Franklin, Louise Merriweather, and Jonathan Weaver. The executive producer of Every Voice and Sing is Eric V. Tate, Jr. For more information about this series and the choral music legacy of the historically black colleges and universities, visit us at www.evt.edu. .org